Chapter 13, Subordination. The expletive deleted computers. When an interviewer asked young nuclear weapons designers at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory to name the worst thing about their profession, this gripe about uncooperative computers was a typical answer. The goddamn computers, they don't have enough capacity and they're always going down. What's a designer of weapons of mass destruction to do? The physicists' startlingly narrow answers were not the result of any pressure to respond quickly, without giving careful consideration to the question. The interviewer reports that nearly all of them did think for a while before answering. Rather, a narrow focus comes naturally to such individuals, who, as good products of the system of professional training, give higher priority to carrying out their assignments than to questioning them, and in any case are not prepared to second-guess the political and ideological framework that engenders and guides their technical work. In the final analysis, the physicists' narrow answers are a sad sign of their subordination, of their approval of a work life that will ultimately give them insufficient satisfaction, a work life in which their employers define the big picture and they innovate safely within it, and in which attempting to alter the picture is not a legitimate on-the-job activity. If an individual professional did have an independent political agenda, it would undermine the ideological discipline and assignable curiosity that ensure that he works in his employer's interest. This is why the system of professional training and the examination that stands at the center of that system favors the individual who sees himself as having a technical orientation rather than a political one. Of course, the technical is itself political. The technically best solution to a given problem is often the one thing from the point of view of those with an interest in maintaining the hierarchy, but something quite different from the point of view of those without power. However, the favored individual sees no class interest in his own work because he internalizes the requisite ideology. He doesn't see himself as following an ideology at all, but as simply doing what he judges to be technically best. The politics usually enter his work not through conscious plotting or calculation, but automatically, when he does what feels right. The result is an ironic situation in which this very political worker sees politics as a dirty word, a word that means not doing what is technically best. Having long ago purged himself of his own political agenda, and having internalized the dominant ideology, the expert sees the problems of the world as fundamentally technical in nature, although certainly exacerbated by politics, but not the other way around. As a 28-year-old Livermore physicist working on third-generation nuclear weapons, which aimed to knock out attacking nuclear weapons, said about the buildup of nuclear arsenals, why not find technical solutions to a technical problem? Whatever the issue, the rebel and the expert stand out in sharp distinction to each other. In any discussion, the expert's lack of political independence, his loyalty, becomes apparent immediately as he confines his thinking to technical solutions, making adjustments, fine-tuning the system. He may offer a multitude of ways to deal with a problem, but, as if by magic, not a single one would reduce the flow of profits or otherwise disturb the hierarchical distribution of power. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives, written by Jeff Schmidt and published in the year 2000. Going on with the next subsection of Chapter 13, which is titled Professionalism. Professionalism, in particular, the notion that experts should confine themselves to their legitimate professional concerns, quote-unquote, and not, quote, politicize their work, helps keep individual professionals in line by encouraging them to view their narrow technical orientation as a virtue, a sign of objectivity rather than of subordination. This doesn't mean that experts are forbidden to let independent political thoughts cross their minds. They can do so as citizens, of course, and they can do so even as experts, but then only in the proper places and in the proper way. The expert is probably a member of a professional association that has a committee on social implications or a forum on the profession and society. Such a group may take up a political issue, but only after it takes a debilitating bow to power, usually in the form of a protracted debate in which those who want to take up the issue must succeed in repackaging it as a legitimate professional concern, often as a technical issue. Members of the group can then take a position on the sanitized issue without, quote, being political, in the sense of acting like they don't know their place. Politically timid professionals fear that their organization will look like part of a social movement, and so they try to limit their organization's actions to those of a narrow special interest group. As part of their very identity, professionals subordinate themselves to power on ideological matters. Thus, professionals can't take a stand on an unsanitized issue without going through a genuine identity crisis. Indeed, they respond with great fear and trembling whenever anyone proposes that they take such a stand. Even on life or death issues, professional associations can rarely muster the courage to take a position that they think might displease employers. Professionals don't want anyone to think that their own views might affect their work, because that would be insubordinate and therefore unprofessional. So even off the job, in professional associations and elsewhere, independence of thought feels out of line. As a result, the typical professional doesn't stand for anything. Thus, for example, it was sad but not surprising when the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association decided not to participate in the massive 25th of April 1993 Gay Rights March on Washington, an event that drew several hundred thousand people, making it one of the largest civil rights demonstrations in American history. Leroy Ahrens, the group's president, explained that members didn't want to endanger their credibility in the industry, quote unquote. As good little professionals, they adjust their very identity for their employers, both on and off the job. They act like journalists who happen to be gay, not like gays who happen to work as journalists. Consider the behavior of the National Association of Black Journalists in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a well-known journalist convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer. A passionate voice for the black community, Abu-Jamal had worked as a radio and print journalist doing news reports and commentary for a number of radio stations and networks, including National Public Radio, which aired his pieces on All Things Considered. The incident that landed Abu-Jamal in prison occurred in 1981, while he was president of the Philadelphia chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists. Late one night, Abu-Jamal happened upon the scene where a police officer had stopped Abu-Jamal's brother for a traffic violation. In the events that followed, the officer shot Abu-Jamal and was fatally shot himself. There is no agreement about who fired first or who shot the officer. Many people felt that Abu-Jamal, a radical and longtime activist with no criminal record, did not receive a fair trial. But years of appeals through the courts were fruitless, and on June 1, 1995, the governor of Pennsylvania ordered prison officials to kill Abu-Jamal by lethal injection at 10 p.m. on August 17, 1995. This touched off a worldwide outcry involving hundreds of thousands of people. Demonstrations, rallies, teach-ins, celebrity speak-outs, op-ed articles, and letter-writing and petition campaigns. 100,000 signers in Rome alone demanded that Abu-Jamal at least be granted a new trial. Scores of organizations, from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch to the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, supported the demand and opposed Abu-Jamal's impending execution, but not the National Association of Black Journalists. In a written statement following a vote by the group's 18-member board of directors, NABJ President Dorothy Butler Gilliam said, "As an organization of journalists, NABJ does not see this unfortunate circumstance as an issue of journalism upon which it feels compelled to take a stand at this time." In spite of Gillian's attempt to make her position sound more reasonable by calling NABJ an organization of journalists rather than an organization of blacks, the group's stand infuriated many people, especially in the black community. One critic spoke for them all when he attributed the group's decision to its domination by members attuned to the subtle grunts and imagined nods of their employers in the corporate media. In response to the barrage of criticism that it received, the NABJ latched onto and took an extra strong stand on a sanitized issue, restrictions that prison officials had put on Abu Jamal's communication with the outside world after he contracted to write Live from Death Row, a book sharply critical of the justice and prison system. Thus, the NABJ was outraged, not because the state planned to kill Abu Jamal, but because it was violating his First Amendment rights, which we find to be a legitimate issue, the group explained. The judge in charge of Abu Jamal's case was a tough cop-on-the-bench type who had sentenced 32 people to death, more than twice as many as any other judge in the country. He had never before granted a stay of execution and was, in the words of the New York Times, openly contemptuous of Abu Jamal. Yet, 10 days before the planned execution, he succumbed to the growing popular pressure and granted Abu Jamal an indefinite stay, allowing Abu Jamal's lawyers to appeal once again to higher courts for a new trial. Generally speaking, the greater the power, whether corporate or state or even oppositional, the more eager professionals are to subordinate themselves to it. The power's morality or immorality usually has only a secondary effect on the professional's eagerness to serve, because good subordinates don't make moral judgments about their superiors. This is the unfortunate but invaluable lesson of history. Historian Conrad Jarisch notes, for example, that in the spring of 1933, most German professionals rushed to curry favor with the new Nazi government. The prestigious German Engineering Association, the Prominent Lawyers Association, the Secondary Teachers Association, and the hundreds of other groups all across Germany pledged their loyalty. The behavior of people in my own field, physics, has been far from exemplary. Before and during World War II, the world's top physicists were German, and these individuals typically accepted invitations to work in support of the Nazi war effort. 2 decades later, during the Vietnam War, the world's top physicists were American, and these individuals typically jumped at the invitation to become members of the Defense Department's JASON organization and work in support of the U.S. side in Vietnam. At the workplace, experts can be somewhat independent in informal discussions, but almost never within their professional work itself. It is considered unprofessional for experts to bring independent political thinking to bear in their work. On the job, their, quote, legitimate professional concerns are largely confined to carrying out their assignments. Thus, while some of the nuclear weapons designers mentioned at the beginning of this chapter worried about computer troubles, others, also well trained in confining themselves to their legitimate professional concerns, worried that international agreements might further restrict testing and thereby make it more difficult for them to carry out their assignment of weapons design. They did not allow the notion that such restrictions on nuclear testing might actually represent social progress to interfere with their work. This view of what is legitimate holds hegemony over professionals in every major area of their employment. It is extreme in some cases, such as the aerospace industry, employer of thousands of scientists. The very notion of an aerospace scientist bringing a critical social perspective to his work is so unusual as to be jarring. The social function of the individual produced by the qualification system is to work uncritically within the political hierarchy, bolstering it through his example of eager participation as well as through his actual work product. When the professional leaves unchallenged the moral authority of his employer to dictate the political context of his work, he surrenders his social existence, his control over the mark he makes on the world. These days, one finds students and professionals who have some awareness of the big picture, but who cynically adjust their behavior for the system. This is quite acceptable to the hierarchy because these individuals, even as they blast distant power figures such as the president, carefully avoid any confrontation with those who hold immediate power over them. As Max Horkheimer said in 1946, in what may be taken as one of the most succinct criticisms of many professionals on today's postmodern scene, well-informed cynicism is only another mode of conformity. However, more than professionalism or cynicism, it is a lack of social vision that assures conformity, and professional training does anything but produce people who envision a more democratic social order. Professionals may complain to you about the unfair treatment that they witness firsthand at work, and they may tell you in excruciating detail about the latest cases of corruption in business and government, just as they read it in the newspaper. But most of them are unable to move from concern to action. Professionals are angry about such abuses of power, but having no vision of how power in the schools, in the workplace, and in the larger society could be distributed more democratically, they naturally look for ways to make the present hierarchical power structure work. Here the choices are limited. Restaff the hierarchy with, quote, better people, or give those at the top even more power so they can act decisively. So even the most well-meaning individuals end up reinventing some such elitist or authoritarian solution. Group action by the rank and file is disobedient and antithetical to making hierarchical authority structures work. So many professionals who are well-informed and concerned about abuses of power will nevertheless not engage in collective acts of solidarity with the victims. They don't seek solidarity even when they themselves are the victims, and it is not unusual to see them leave their jobs rather than speak out openly and improve the situation through collective action. For the same reason, they will not identify with a specific movement or work with organizations that have independent social agendas. Those who have no vision of greater democracy are paralyzed even further by the individualism inherent in their outlook. They retreat in fear at the mere suggestion of joining with others in struggle, for those who act as part of a group admit to being less than autonomous individuals and give up the comforting fiction that they meet their bosses as equals. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Continuing on with the next subsection of Chapter 13, Conflicts with Employers. The professional, like any employee, does have conflicts with his employer, but because he is an intellectual employee, he is not free to arrive at just any understanding of the root cause of these on-the-job disputes. Specifically, under normal circumstances, he cannot allow himself to view his problems with his employer as an outgrowth of a fundamental conflict of interest, for to do so would sabotage the ideological discipline that allows him to serve his employer's interest in his work and keep his job as a professional. Thus, the professional sees his clashes as originating in conflicting technical judgments over how best to pursue universal interests. He sees conflicting strategies or personalities, but doesn't see himself as having a fundamental conflict of interest with his employer or with the powerful in society in general. That is, he doesn't see his own conflict with his employer as part of a larger conflict between labor and capital. When those who would wield power act against his and his fellow employees' interests, the professional does not see them as opponents acting against employee interests, but as incompetents acting against universal interests. Thus, he calls not for breaking down the hierarchy and distributing power democratically to those who do the work, but for more intelligence at the top, an elitist approach, which weakens alliances with non-professionals. He challenges the staffing, not the structure. He fumes. Incompetence! Stupid bureaucrats! Those idiots don't know what they're doing. In the eyes of the professional, those with authority at worst lack intelligence or information. He dared not admit to himself that those he serves may be smart and well-informed, but simply have different class interests. That is, he cannot risk admitting to himself that he has been hired to serve interests that conflict with his own. This restricted understanding renders the professional weak as a force for his own defense and impotent as a force for change in society. His protestations are impotent, because no matter how militantly stated, they are not threats to break down ideological discipline. They don't threaten to affect the political content of his work, as having an independent political agenda certainly would. Even his strongest indictment of decisions made by management, "It's all political," suggests a mythical non-political approach, rather than an alternative distribution of political power. The louder he shouts his carefully restricted criticisms, the more he proclaims his subordination. No professional maintains perfect ideological discipline, and every straying leads to a run-in with management. Of course, some professionals have more clashes than others. In particular, those who are the least strict about subordinating their own vision to that of the institution that employs them are the ones who find themselves in trouble most often. But these conflict-plague employees rarely understand that their poor ideological discipline is the source of their clashes. They avoid such an understanding because it is inherently radical. It exposes their employer's ideology and is critical of it. To avoid taking such a radical step, professionals come up with other, often far-fetched, explanations of their conflicts with management, as the following discussion of two common types of workplace conflict suggests. Let's look first at conflicts over employees' demands for excellence, and then at conflicts over employers' demands for conformity. Employers reward mediocrity and punish excellence. At least, that's what many disillusioned professionals have concluded. In reality, of course, management has no such operating principle. Yet countless professionals have found that when they take initiative on the job and work with dedication to further the ends they thought they were hired to further, they get criticism from the boss, or they are treated as some sort of threat. Meanwhile, they see that co-workers with take-the-money-and-run attitudes are hassled less. When devoted professionals complain that they are given grief for doing outstanding work, you usually find that they have decided for themselves which aspects of their jobs deserve the highest priority and the most attention. This assertion of their own agenda, not the excellence with which they pursue it, is what gets them in trouble. The chance to work toward their own goals renews their enthusiasm and inspires them to do what they feel is unusually excellent work. Co-workers typically agree, as do clients, but management is unhappy. Professionals, bewildered by their boss's negative reaction to their special efforts, but unable to recognize the difference between their agenda and their employer's, conclude that the problem is that management is too stupid to recognize quality work. What is really a conflict over goals appears to professionals to be a dispute over excellence. Other professionals escape such disputes. These are the individuals whose goals match those of the institutions that employ them, or who are willing and able to subordinate their own goals. Institutions demand conformity and obedience, and yet hire professionals to do work that requires creativity and questioning. Does this make employer-employee conflict inevitable? Liberals say yes. They enjoy believing that intellectuals are unbridled thinkers, and therefore a threat to those in power. This is a corollary of their elitist belief that non-intellectual workers support the status quo. But I would argue that institutional demands for political conformity lead to conflict only when individual creative workers have independent political agendas and are not willing to subordinate them. For if professionals adopt their employers' agendas, then their creativity and questioning work is toward meeting their employer's goals. The work product in that case is essentially the same as it would be had the employers done the creative work themselves. The sad fact is, mainstream professionals don't need political freedom to do their creative work, and they don't demand that their employers allow them to exercise political freedom in their work. Only when professionals have an independent political agenda do they need and demand freedom, because only then might their creative work displease their employers. Scientists are a good example. During Joseph Stalin's reign of terror in the Soviet Union, tens of thousands of scientists and engineers were arrested, imprisoned, and sometimes executed. Yet Soviet science advanced rapidly and came to lead the world in many fields, including mathematics and theoretical physics. Until the mid-1950s, some of the Soviet Union's most eminent scientists worked in prison laboratories. At the height of the repression, Soviet physicists did work that won them 5 Nobel Prizes. One of those physicists, a Soviet citizen named Pyotr Kapitsa, had been living in England for 13 years when, upon a routine visit to the Soviet Union to attend a conference, Soviet authorities seized him on Stalin's orders and wouldn't let him return home to England. Within a few years of this kidnapping, Stalin had Kapitsa running a Soviet laboratory and doing the most creative work of his career. As Lauren R. Graham, a science historian at Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has documented, scientists do not require academic freedom to do their creative work. They just need funding. One haunting image that Graham describes is that of the young scientist Andrei Sakharov sitting at his desk at Arzamas 16 doing his famous work in theoretical physics and gazing out the window at brutal armed guards marching rows of political prisoners to their jobs at the scientific installation, which was the Soviet equivalent of the Los Alamos National Laboratory in the United States. Years later, Sakharov became a dissident, but that was unusual for a scientist. As Graham notes, even when the Soviet Union was on the verge of collapse, the leaders of Soviet science sided with the old order. Those naive enough to believe that the professional's creative thinking alone leads to conflict with management probably also subscribe to the myth that intellectual workers' professional obligations lead to conflict too. No one illustrates better than the mainstream journalist that there is no tension between fulfilling a professional obligation or doing a professional job and institutional demands for conformity and obedience. Reporters who write front-page stories for the New York Times are considered to be among the top journalists in the profession. It is abundantly evident that the paper they work for requires that the stories be written within a framework of general support for the U.S. political and economic system, and that the stories anticipate and head off any possible faith-threatening interpretations of the facts being reported. Times reporters conform strictly to the paper's politics and at the same time feel that they are fulfilling their professional obligations to, quote, get the story. There's rarely a serious complaint from either side. Only when professionals have an independent political agenda do they argue with their bosses about what constitutes a professional job. When Times editors assign one of their politically reliable, top-of-the-line journalists to cover a sensitive story, they don't worry that professional obligations will lead their reporter to frame the story in a way that skewers the paper's fundamental tenets. Thus, for example, most mainstream media in the end reported the Watergate affair not as evidence of the political system's tendency toward corruption, but as evidence that the system works and cleanses itself. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. And on to the conclusion of Chapter 13, which is titled Subordination, with the final subsection titled Pre-Professionals. As we know, not all students become clones of the prototypical professional described above. But those who are headed in that direction are easy to spot, because their subordinate attitude is conspicuous early on at the training institution. These students scramble to figure out the rules of the game in their university graduate department or professional school, and then they literally compete to adjust themselves appropriately. Being not merely adjustable but self-adjusting, they are good students in the eyes of the faculty. For the same reason, they will be good professionals in the eyes of their employers. These students do not simply refrain from acts of insubordination, such as challenging the training institution's agenda or criticizing the ways that agenda reflects the needs of the larger system. Rather, they enthusiastically embrace the system of professional qualification and defend the qualifying examination. The personal strategy of these skilled submissives is to play the game, to use the qualifying examination to demonstrate on the system's terms that they are good, that is, well adapted, to be certified with a credential, and to get a job with a new set of rules to submit to. In short, this means integrating themselves into the system, being dwarfed by it but surviving, if not as independent forces for change in society, then at least as well-fed biological entities serving the status quo. These students also subordinate the dreams they once had of experiencing the totality of their subject in all its technical and social dimensions. In what can be seen as a sad attempt to imitate this foregone experience, some students treat the small problem parts assigned to them as if they were interesting enough in and of themselves to play the role of a surrogate totality. Today, these assignments are the catechism-like test preparation problems. Tomorrow, the narrow thesis problems, and thereafter, the corporate problem segment. Many students do resist making the appropriate adjustments and heading down the designated road. Unwilling to reorient their outlook and goals, they find themselves in conflict with one or another action or policy of the training institution. These students usually struggle individually and indirectly, misunderstanding their problems in the training program as simply personal and not as the inevitable result of the system-serving nature of the training institution's goals. Though they often leave the training program, they should not be looked at as losers, for they have not necessarily been broken and may go on to struggle elsewhere. The system of professional training is set up to turn students into good self-adjusters or else get rid of them. Through the mechanisms of pressure and scrutiny that I have described in this book, it usually succeeds in doing one or the other. However, students can and sometimes do frustrate the system by both confronting it and remaining, but this is accomplished only through politically conscious, organized action, as I discuss in the next two chapters. At the core of the conflict is an unstated but highly contentious issue: Who will the student become? Professional training programs work routinely, methodically, and often consciously to turn students into very different persons, and so individuals who want to control who they are must fight to do so.